somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 24, Expert Opinion, with Stephen Solomon, Part 2. In 1787, the recently adopted American Constitution was sent out to the states for ratification. Despite fierce objections from anti-federalists, the Constitution did not include a Bill of Rights protecting freedom of speech and the press. The anti-federalist newspaper The Independent Gazetteer published an ironic comment on what the future of free speech would look like if the Constitution was adopted.
Ah, what glorious days are coming! How I anticipate the brilliancy of the American court! Here is the President going in state to the Senate House to confirm the law for the abolition of the liberty of the press. Men and brethren, will not these things be so?
Even though a Bill of Rights was adopted in 1791, the Independent Gazetteer's withering sarcasm had been prophetic. In July 1798, Congress passed the Sedition Act, which made it a crime to
write, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government of the United States or either House of the Congress of the United States or the President of the United States with intent to defame or to bring them into contempt or disrepute or to excite against them the hatred of the good people of the United States.
A mere 7 years after the adoption of the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment's promise that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, Congress had done just that, paving the way for the prosecution and imprisonment of both journalists, editors, and politicians engaging in political speech. So in this episode, we'll explore how Americans who had championed freedom of speech as the great bulwark of liberty and thumped their noses at English sedition laws in the lead-up to the Revolution came to adopt their own sedition law. With me to discuss this critical chapter of American free speech is NYU professor and founder of First Amendment Watch, Stephen Solomon. If you think, wait a minute, I've already listened to the expert opinion with Stephen Solomon, you're right. Since Steve was also our featured guest in the last episode, I was planning to talk to Julie Silverbrook, who is the executive director of the Constitutional Source Project, but Julie had to pull out for personal reasons. But since I'm in New York, Steve graciously agreed to jump in and continue from where we left off in the last episode with the adoption of the First Amendment. Steve, welcome back on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on again, not least because for once I actually get to do an expert opinion with my esteemed guest being physically present. We've actually just been discussing American and European approaches to hate speech on social media with students in two of your classes here at NYU, and we're about to be on a panel with Nadine Strossen and Irina Manta on the same topic. But before we get into the digital age, I want to travel back in time when the printing press was still the cutting edge of communication technology and talk about the Sedition Act. But once again, thanks for agreeing to do this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate your inviting me back on.
So let's start with the background. We're in the 1790s. American political unity has basically broken down with Federalists and Democratic Republicans, or Republicans for short, clashing over the proper role of government versus the rights of individuals and states, and also whether to support the British or the French, who were locked in bitter warfare. And you have legendary figures like Washington, Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson who are sniping at each other, and the press is overflowing with partisan vituperation. I love this quote from Washington at the end of his administration, where he says that he had no ideas that reports would be made in such exaggerated and indecent terms as could scarcely be applied to a Nero, a notorious defaulter, or even to a common pickpocket. But what really sets the wheels towards the Sedition Act in motion is a breakdown of relations with France. What is it that happens?
So France was at war with most of Europe, really, and with England, and they were starting to make rumblings of war against the United States. Of course, this was in the first decade of the country's existence. It didn't have much of an army or navy. And so this, you know, the threats from France constituted something to really worry about. And so the Adams administration started building warships. They started recruiting people for an army. And the country was getting towards war footing.
Yeah, and it's Adams who's come in after Washington as the country's second president. And he's treated no more respectfully than Washington, of course. There's a Republican newspaper called the Aurora, which we might get back to, which called him the querulous, bald, blind, and crippled Adams. This helps inspire Federalists to say we need to crack down on Republican dissent.
Well, yes. And then they passed legislation that became very controversial. You had the Alien Acts, which enabled the Adams administration to identify aliens, specifically French people in the United States, either as citizens or as immigrants, and expel them if they constituted a threat to the national security. And they also passed the infamous Sedition Act of 1798, in which they criminalized speech against the government.
Yeah. What's interesting is that the Federalists, like Adams, they hold the presidency and they have a solid majority in both houses of Congress. And also most newspapers were leaning Federalists. So why do they think they need to adopt this nuclear option of criminalizing sedition when basically they run the country?
So this is the first time in American history when the, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of the press was challenged during a time of national security. And so they really were worried about national security at that point. And they passed these laws to deal with possibility of internal subversion, you know, people criticizing the government, criticizing policy, and perhaps getting together like-minded people and actively opposing the government and subverting the national security. And of course, they didn't trust the French in particular, French citizens or French immigrants, and so that accounted for both of these laws. So it was a concern over national security, and there would be many more times in American history, of course, when the freedoms of speech and press would be at risk because of concerns over the national security of the United States.
And of course, they had also witnessed the French Revolution sort of descending into the terror, the execution of a king, and the guillotining of many of those who had been supportive of the American Revolution. So there was a genuine fear of where, you know, if democracy went too far, the violent mobs might be unleashed on the streets of America as well.
Right. And I think there was some concern about how speech and press played into forming those mobs. So we have a couple centuries of history now to guide us, but they didn't have it then.
Let's dive deeper into the actual wording of the law. What was it that so alarmed its critics, mainly the Republicans?
Well, if you look at the law and the wording, there's the law says that it was a crime to publish, and here I quote, false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government, or either House of Congress or the president, to bring them into contempt or disrepute, to excite against them the hatred of the people. Now, there's a number of things that are wrong with this, or a real problem. I mean, what is scandalous? Mm-hmm. It's a word of infinitely elastic meaning, and really any writer could bring about a scandal by raising questions about John Adams and how he conducted the government and opinions about his policies and things like that. Even more than that. It was obvious on the face of the law that it was aimed at suppressing the opposition And that's because the law was specifically mentioned writings against the president. And the president, of course, was Federalist, John Adams. It also specifically mentioned writings against Congress. Both houses of Congress were controlled by the Federalists. It specifically did not mention who? The vice president.
Yeah, exactly.
Why would it leave out the vice president? Well, the vice president happened to be Thomas Jefferson, who was not a Federalist. He was a Democratic Republican. And so he was not protected. And so you can see that some of this may have been generated by a true concern about national security, but when it actually got down to writing the law, it was aimed at the political opposition. So it protected Federalist politicians from criticism.
And also it expired.
Yeah, there was a sunset provision. how did that get there? I mean, the law expired on its own in 1801 in March on Inauguration Day for the new president, whoever that would be. And the Federalists who passed the law, I suppose, were worried that if they lost the next election, the law, if it was still there, could be used against them.
Yeah.
So they had this automatic sunset provision, and that would take care of that potential problem.
But, I mean, if we are to sort of look for good faith on the part of the Federalist, the Act did offer two substantial improvements from the crime of seditious libel under English common law. Can you mention those two improvements?
Yeah. So libertarians for at least a century in America had argued that a defense to seditious libel would be criticism of the government, should be the defense of truth, should be available. And they also argued for an expansion of the role of the jury to safeguard the rights of the accused. So both of those were, those advances were written into the Sedition Act of 1798. The problem was, once they were written into the law and the prosecutions took place, it quickly became clear that those much wished for advances in libertarian philosophy about freedom of speech really had no effect, no positive effect in defending free speech. And that's because the defense of truth only would work if someone had made factual accusations. Most of the Sedition Act prosecutions were based on opinions about John Adams and his administration. And so when these cases went into court, it was impossible to prove the truth of an opinion. And so the defense of truth was useless. They really couldn't effectively defend themselves in that. And then in terms of expanding the role of the jury to decide a case, when you look at the trials and how they were conducted, the judges at the time were very prejudiced against the defendants and took control of the trial, and in a way that is hard to imagine today. So the role of the jury being expanded, it was kind of theoretical in terms of these cases, because they really didn't have much of a role except to do what the judges instructed them to do.
Yeah, so there was actually also a due process element in these cases. Only in 1791, the First Amendment had been adopted as part of the Bill of Rights, and the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law abridging free speech and freedom of the press and so on. That seems to fly in the face of the Sedition Act, but the Federalists, you know, insisted strongly that the Sedition Act was constitutional. What were their main arguments?
The Federalists argued that the freedom of speech and press meant the freedom that was protected under English common law. Now, under English common law, there had been two ways to control publications. One was to subject them to prior censorship, so people would actually read the articles and say whether they could be published or not. The other way, that was before publication, obviously. After publication, they had a system of punishment called seditious libel, which we mentioned before. So pre-publication censorship post-publication punishment. This censorship system expired around 1694. Parliament did not renew it. And so the meaning of freedom of the press in England under the common law meant the freedom from prior censorship or prior restraints. And so it did not mean that you couldn't be punished afterwards. So this system of common law was adopted in the colonies and then in the early years of the country. And so the Federalists argued that when you talk about when the First Amendment protects the freedom of speech, can't abridge it. Nothing was abridged by the Sedition Act that was not previously protected. So seditious utterances were not protected under English common law, and so nothing was abridged that wasn't previously protected. And they argued that Congress had the power to pass laws that were necessary and proper. The necessary and proper clause in Article One, necessary and proper to carrying out the enumerated powers that Congress had. And so they argued that since Congress had the power to punish resistance to lawful authority, that they could also pass laws that kind of backed up in time from that and go at publications and writings that might bring about unlawful resistance. This was called the bad tendency test. And so if a writing had a tendency to cause illegal acts in the future, however tenuous that connection, they claimed the authority under the Constitution to restrict or punish that kind of speech. It was kind of a boundless theory because you can imagine any criticism of the government could at some point in the future excite people, gain adherence by a large number of people, and lead to changes that the party in power didn't like. And so the necessary and proper clause was used as well to justify power that Congress was not explicitly given under the Constitution.
How genuine was this argument? Because John Adams, I remember, you know, when you had the whole conflict over the Stamp Act and when the British tried to bring seditious libel cases and British governors against the printers' guilds and eads in Boston, he sort of praised them and he warned about how the jaws of power always tried to sort of control the press. And he made very, very elaborate case against seditious libel cases being brought against colonists who protested the British. And now his administration turns around and says, now that we're in power, actually seditious libel is a great idea.
So it's easier to be a libertarian when you're out of power than it is when you're in power and subject to all the slings of and arrows of outrageous criticism. And we're all human beings. I suppose there's something to the idea that when you take, you know, when you assume power and you think that what you're doing is in the best interest of the country and you get basically assaulted verbally, and some of it is very personal, some of it is involves, you know, really vitriolic speech, that you know, it may wear on you after a while.
Yeah.
And so you might actually, you know, start to favor laws that would restrict or punish that kind of speech. So that might be part of what was going on. And I think you also have to refer back to what we were talking about before, about maybe there was at least part of this started out as a genuine fear for the security of the United States in terms of the threat from France. So that may have been part of it, but as we discussed, in the actual execution of the law, the way it was written and the way it was enforced against the political opposition, it looks more like political suppression than it does protecting the interests of the United States vis-a-vis a foreign power.
Yeah. Another quote from a newspaper about Adams called him a hideous hermaphroditical character, which is neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. And of course, we had already mentioned the old querulous, bald, blind, crippled, and toothless Adams. So these were just a few of the invectives.
Yeah, but you can also see that they're really not about policy, are they?
No.
They're personal insults.
But they were, so, there were also sort of accusations that the Federalists were creating a monarchy along British lines that sort of subverted the whole idea behind the American Revolution.
Yeah, but these were political opinions and not at all dangerous to the American government or national security. So, and again, these were opinions that could not be addressed in court in terms of truth or falsity. So you really didn't have a defense of truth if he said that Adams, you know, his administration would lead to a monarchy. It's not provable. So defense of truth doesn't really help you there.
Now, Madison and Jefferson were clearly not impressed. Madison called the bill, when it went before Congress, a monster that must forever disgrace its parents. They rallied opposition to the Sedition Act with the so-called Kentucky and Virginia Resolution. And in his famous speech called The Report of 1800, Madison gave a detailed account of why the Sedition Act violated the First Amendment. So what were Madison's main arguments against the constitutionality of the Sedition Act?
Madison wrote a magnificent defense of freedom of speech and freedom of the press in his Report of 1800 to the Virginia House of Delegates. And I think it stands today as one of the strongest statements for a free press in America. And this is more than 200 years later. And he argued in constitutional terms that Congress could act only through enumerated powers. And the Congress was given no power over the press. And so it had no power to pass laws. In addition to not having enumerated power, there was an amendment, the First Amendment, that made clear that it had no power. So no enumerated power, and it's an express denial of power in the First Amendment. So that was a pretty strong argument. So the question that that Madison asked was, okay, so where do you draw the power to pass the Sedition Act? It's a violation of the Constitution, a violation of the Bill of Rights. No power exists to do that. The other thing he said, which was goes beyond the power of Congress, goes to the idea of what kind of country had been established here. And sovereignty, he said, was in the people, not in the government. It was a representative form of government. People had to be able to criticize public officials, criticize public policy, freely discuss things, because after all, they had the power to elect and unelect those who represented them. And so there had to be free discussion. Freedom of the press and freedom of speech was critical to self-governance and sovereignty in the people.
And this goes back, it's basically an elaboration on the speech that he makes in 1789 when he presents his draft Bill of Rights, including what will become the First Amendment, and where he contrasts the new American Constitution with the British Constitution, where sovereignty is in Parliament, and therefore British citizens do not enjoy as elaborate free speech.
That's right. And in America, the revolution in government was taking the power and sovereignty away from the government and residing that in the people themselves. So the people would control, the people would elect their representatives, decide whether those representatives would continue in office. And that required, that form of government required, absolutely required a free press. It required free speech.
He also makes some arguments that I think are really prescient today. So he says that some degree of abuse is inseparable from the proper use of everything, and in no instance is this more true than in that of the press. So he basically acknowledges that, yes, free speech and press freedom can be used for obnoxious causes and ideas and opinions, but that it's more dangerous to censor the press than allowing these abuses or whatever you want to call them.
Yes, and he was well aware of all the protests in the founding period against British authority and against the taxes that were imposed on the colonies. And some of that speech was really vitriolic. And, you know, we remember back to the Liberty Trees and Liberty Poles when they would hang the British Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And next to an effigy of the devil. And in Boston, how much worse a thing can you say about someone? You know, the devil was the incarnation of all evil in Puritan theology, and there the devil was hanging next to the British Prime Minister in effigy.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So that was shocking. That was shocking speech, and that's what they grew up in terms of the founding of the country.
He also says the fetters imposed on liberty at home have ever been forged out of the weapons provided for defense against real, pretended, or imaginary dangers from abroad. So here he clearly sees that whenever a government feels threatened by both internal and external threats, that's where free speech is most in danger, and that's where you're most likely to overreact and become censorious. And I guess that was not only precise at that time, but also in later instances in American history.
It certainly happens again and again through American history. And I think Madison would say probably during times of national stress, freedom of speech is needed more than in any other time.
Sure. Now, Adams was a bit sort of aloof. He tries to say after he's out of office that he really had nothing to do with the Sedition Act and that he was not in favor of it, but it was necessary. And, you know, it was actually Alexander Hamilton who pushed this idea. And then he said, OK, I'll go along with it. In Charles Slack's great book about the Sedition Act, I think he makes a convincing case why that's not the correct story. But it's certainly true that Adams was not the main enforcer of the Sedition Act. He had a pretty odious enforcer in Secretary of State Timothy Pickering. He seemed to be pretty vigorous in his enforcement of the Sedition Act.
Well, Abigail Adams, who was a very good judge of character, actually wrote of Pickering, and Pickering was an ally of her husband, wrote of Pickering that he was, quote, a man whose manners are forbidding, whose temper is sour, and whose resentments are implacable. And this is the fellow who's in charge of enforcing the Sedition Act.
Yeah.
And so how did he enforce it? Well, he, you know, today, of course, we can read stuff online and get things that are published all over and instantaneously. But back then, you know, there were basically newspapers, and it took a while for the copies to get to you and so forth. So he would read a lot of newspapers and look for what he thought were seditious publications. But he also set up a network of informers who would, you know, throughout the country, who would read the newspapers and anything else, broadsides, whatever was published, and inform him by letter. And perhaps send a copy of the offending publication to let him know what was going on and who was writing what.
Yeah. Incidentally, Abigail Adams actually seems to be one of those who also whispered in John Adams's ear that it might be a good idea to crack down on seditious libel. She seems to have been quite upset about what she read about her husband.
Well, she was appropriately defensive as someone would be in that position. But I think both of them, as you said, regretted the Sedition Act. And Adams, for good reason, tried to distance himself from it because in the end, you know, a lot of historians conclude that it was the Sedition Act, among other things, that led to Adams' loss in the election of 1800 and the disappearance of the Federalist Party. Basically, they disappeared about 15 or 20 years later.
Yeah.
The repression during those couple years with newspaper editors going to jail, a congressman going to jail, and a random assortment of other people saying things that, came before Pickering and were prosecuted, that was, people didn't like that, and they voted Adams out of office.
Do we know how many people were prosecuted and punished under the Sedition Act? And also, what types of speech, what kind of comments were prosecuted?
It's hard to determine exact numbers here because of records not being specific or perhaps missing. But it seems to be true that about 15 prosecutions took place. Probably 9 of them under the Sedition Act, itself. There were also prosecutions under some state laws and also some prosecutions under the common law. But probably around nine that we can count. There were about 10 convictions for seditious libel. There's records of five opposition newspapers shutting down or suspending operations because their editors went to jail. So it was a very serious couple years of political repression.
One of the most prominent victims of the Sedition Act was quite a colorful character, a member of Congress, but also a newspaper editor called Matthew Lyon. Why was Pickering out to get him?
You know, if Pickering was going to go after one person, it would be Lyon. I mean, he was a colorful character. He was a member of Congress. He was always criticizing Adams. And as you pointed out, he was not only a member of Congress, where he had a pretty good visibility, but he also had a newspaper back in his home state of Vermont that was publishing criticisms of Adams on a regular basis. And so he got a lot of attention for that. And he also had a bit of a temper. And one time he had a confrontation over some things he said on the floor of a house with a Federalist congressman named Roger Griswold. And Matthew Lyon spit in his face in response. And then a couple of days later, Griswold came in to the floor of the house with his cane and started, you know, beating up Matthew Lyon, in which case, you know, both of them started wrestling on the floor of the house. And then the Federalists tried to, you know, vote a censure and throw Lyon out. They were unable to do that. So he was a prominent character to go after. And so they did.
What was it that he wrote that got him in trouble?
Well, I think he wrote of Adams. He wrote a number of things about Adams that were quite negative, but he accused Adams of, quote, having unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and selfish avarice. Now, again, you know, why would you throw somebody in jail for saying those things? It doesn't threaten the country. It's a personal attack. And so when you use the laws, the criminal laws, to punish a political opponent who insults you personally, then you get an idea of what's really going on.
Yeah. We already mentioned the Aurora, which was edited by Benjamin Franklin Bache. So he was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, had been with Benjamin Franklin in France. But, you know, he was a target of seditious libel prosecutions, I think under common law, not the Sedition Act as mm-hmm. such. But why was he so loathed by the Federalists? Why was he the natural target?
Well, he was as good at vitriol as his grandfather, Benjamin Franklin, was as good at statesmanship. I mean, he had it built to an art form. And so he attacked President Washington. He accused Washington of all kinds of things and made Washington's life miserable. And then when Adams took office, he launched attacks on Adams as well. And so he was probably the most prominent critic of the Adams administration. So he was a logical target for a prosecution. And so they did. They went after him. They indicted him, but before he could come to trial, he was saved by yellow fever. He died of yellow fever in a plague that hit Philadelphia in 1798. But he clearly would have gone to jail for a while. But he was saved from prosecution under the Sedition Act. Otherwise, he would have been a victim of the law if he hadn't been a victim of yellow fever.
But it's interesting, he writes something like that circulation of the Aurora sort of goes through the roof after the passing of the Sedition Act and after the indictment. So he basically gets a larger audience and makes more money off his newspaper, gets his anti-federalist views out there more prominently after he becomes the target of seditious libel indictment.
Yes. And if you look at this period of about 2.5 years where the prosecutions took place, you see the American political character forming, because despite the political repression and the prosecutions under the Sedition Act, people didn't go into their storm cellars, you know, and wait for the storm to pass. They were still publishing. They were still criticizing Adams. The number of opposition papers increased dramatically during this period, even though a few had to shut down. So the repression had an opposite effect. It brought out more criticism. In a free society, that's what happens, and that's what still happens today. Repression of political speech, at least in this country, brings out more political speech. And so, yes, there were more opposition newspapers formed during this period. The circulation of the existing papers went up. And so for those who didn't go to jail, you might have made a good business out of it.
Yeah, almost like a scene from a movie that you had petitions organized throughout the country where people would sign these petitions, and thousands of these signatures just came streaming into Congress. And you see these Federalist congressmen sitting there and realizing, maybe this wasn't a great idea.
Maybe this wasn't a great idea, exactly. Yeah.
So maybe we should call it like the John Adams effect rather than the Barbara Streisand effect.
Right, and so they paid the price in the election of 1800, because they not only lost the presidency, but they lost control of both houses of Congress.
Yeah. Among those prosecuted, there was also a guy who erected a Liberty Pole as a protest against the Sedition Act.
So David Brown was a political dissident who sort of traveled around the country giving speeches. And he was an interesting character. He fought in the Revolutionary War in Washington's army and was quite a patriot. But he didn't like Adams, didn't like Adams' administration policies. And so he went around, you know, the country, and he took temporary work, and he spoke out against Adams. So he arrives in Dedham, Massachusetts, which was a Republican stronghold. And they erected a Liberty Tree. Now, this is, of course, Massachusetts, close to Boston. And during the run-up to the Revolutionary War, during all the protests in Boston, of course, there were liberty trees and effigies and so forth. And Adams, in his diary, remarked positively about you know, the liberty trees in Boston and the effect that they were having, this, you know, the spirit of liberty kind of thing. And so once again, the liberty tree went up in Massachusetts, but this time it was against Adams, right, because he was president. And despite what he had said before about Liberty Trees, his administration prosecuted Brown for seditious libel for what he was saying about Adams, especially there in Dedham. And Brown was convicted, and I think he, if I remember correctly, served something like 18 months in prison. It's a long time to spend in prison for something, again, that was a fairly mild criticism, and certainly not something that one would look at and say, wow, the country is at risk here because of this incendiary person. I mean, he wasn't really incendiary. He was someone who felt strongly about the political situation and voiced his views.
Yeah. We've already alluded to it a bit, but of course the courts were supposed to be the neutral arbiters of these seditious libel cases. But how did they live up to that role?
Very poorly. So a lot of these cases were actually conducted by Supreme Court justices who were riding circuit. So they literally go around the country. They had districts that they would supervise, and they would ride into town and hear cases. And Justice Chase was particularly repressive in these cases. He would hold trials. For example, he was riding to Maryland and read something that James Callender had written. James Callender was a journalist of strong opinions. And Chase initiated a prosecution of Callender. Now, that we think today that that's done by a prosecutor, right? Who goes before a grand jury, and there's all kinds of protections. But this was initiated by a Supreme Court justice who was then holding the trial. And Justice Chase presided over the trial, and he ruled out a lot of the evidence that the defendant offered to defend himself. And he, you know, in the end, he sentenced him to 9 months in prison and a fine of a couple hundred dollars, which was a really big penalty. And
was, James Callender was sentenced to 9 months.
Yeah.
I love the fact that Samuel Chase was known as Old Bacon Face because apparently he looked really old and angry. So that lives up perfectly to his reputation as someone who vigorously enforced this in a very partisan way. So we've established that Republican newspapers actually doubled their subscriptions. We've seen that in many ways, ordinary Americans rallied, protested the Sedition Act. So did it serve its purpose, or was it a huge own goal?
I think it was probably the worst thing that the Federalists could have done, because they lost the next election. And they lost the presidency, they lost both houses of Congress, and it was probably in large part because of the repression of this period brought a backlash.
But on the positive side, could you say that the Sedition Act helped crystallize the meaning and scope of the First Amendment? Because it, as we also discussed in the last episode, it was not exactly clear what was meant with the First Amendment, but this forced everyone to think about the meaning of the First Amendment when it came to free speech and press freedom.
So James Madison took to the Virginia House of Delegates and explained what the First Amendment meant to him in 1800. And as we mentioned before, it was a wide-ranging defense of freedom of speech and its role in a free society. The idea that, you know, in a representative democracy, the people had to be able to freely examine public characters and measures, as he put it, you know, the freedom to criticize people. It's almost like even if you didn't have a First Amendment, the fact that you had a representative form of government where you engaged in regular elections almost implied what the First Amendment protected, because you really couldn't have a representative democracy without the right to full and free public discussion, which included, you know, the protection for criticizing those who were in power.
So Jefferson becomes president. He wins the presidential election against Adams, and the Sedition Act lapses. But in his inauguration speech, Jefferson addresses the issue of freedom of speech and indirectly, I guess, attacks the Sedition Act. It's really a great speech. So what's the gist of Jefferson's words?
Where is Jefferson when we need him? It'd be great to have him back today delivering the same speech as he delivered at his inauguration, because he sought to unify the country when he could have taken retribution against his political foes, the ones who, you know, like Adams and the Federalists, who had prosecuted so many of the Democratic Republicans. But instead, Jefferson stands up before Congress, and he seeks to unify the country after the jailing of all these political dissenters. And what does he say? He says, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." So it's a call to unity. It's you know, like, we're all Americans. It doesn't matter of our political persuasion. And he also went on to say, and I'll quote here, because it's such a powerful statement for freedom of speech: "If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this union or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated, where reason is left free to combat it." So that's a very clear statement that, you know, even if you wish to, you know, your speech advocates dissolving the union, that, you know, that speech that should be protected as well, as long as the country is free to discuss the merits of that that suggestion. That's a big statement for freedom of speech and freedom of the press, especially in the context of what had come and happened in the last couple of years before that, with the jailing of dissenters.
You mentioned in the beginning that it's easy to be a libertarian when you're in power, and Jefferson himself, when he became president, quickly became disillusioned with the press. He wrote in a letter from 1803, he complained about Federalist newspapers that undermine press freedom by pushing its licentiousness and its lying to such a degree of prostitution as to deprive it of all credit. I have therefore long thought that a few prosecutions of the most eminent offenders would have a wholesome effect in restoring the integrity of the presses. So that's quite a deviation from the Jefferson who wrote that were it left for me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. But even if he wished to prosecute, sort of secretly to prosecute newspapers, did he go down the Adams Road or did he rein in himself?
He largely reined in himself. There were some prosecutions during his time in office. He had his fingerprints on a couple of them, but it was nothing like the deliberate, broad-based prosecutions of the Adams administration. So there were some state prosecutions that he encouraged, or he just sort of looked away and let them happen. And, you know, he should take some responsibility for that. I think, you know, when he gets into office in 1801, you know, there's nothing like absorbing the criticism of people, the vituperative, caustic.
You know, like James Callender, who he had actually been funding to criticize Adams, he then turns around and basically blows the lid on how Jefferson has had a slave, that he's been sleeping with a slave and fathered several children with.
Yeah, so of course he doesn't like that. And so, you know, the natural reaction is, how can I shut that up? How can I threaten the press and so forth, because it becomes a personal matter.
Last question. Today, the American political landscape is also deeply polarized, to put it mildly. Would it be possible under the Constitution to pass a new Sedition Act today?
It would certainly be possible to pass one, but it would be struck down by the courts quite clearly, because the decision of New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964, which stands as a major achievement of First Amendment law, makes that impossible to sustain, because the 1964 decision looked at a law, a libel law in Alabama that was used as a seditious libel law. It was used that way, utilized against the New York Times, which had published an advertisement that was critical of a public official there. And the court, although the Sedition Act had expired, you know, in 1801, and had never been judged by the Supreme Court, the court in 1964 went back and said, well, you know, that law did not survive the judgment of history, and it was unconstitutional under at least our current idea of what the First Amendment protects. And whereas seditious libel would punish dissenters for criticizing government policy, criticizing government officials, the Supreme Court in Sullivan said that the central meaning of the First Amendment was that debate on public issues should be, and these are the words of the court, uninhibited, robust, and wide open. And the court said that wide open speech would include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. So listen to those words: uninhibited, robust, wide open, vehement, caustic, unpleasantly sharp attacks. So to say that those kinds of attacks are protected by the First Amendment as a central meaning of the First Amendment is a direct rejection of all those prosecutions under the Sedition Act you know, those criticisms of Adams, a direct repudiation of any kind of law that would subject people in the United States to punishment for criticizing the government that was their servant.
Steve, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. In a few minutes, you and I will be on a panel here at NYU. I've really enjoyed being immersed here at NYU's School of Journalism throughout the day. It's been a day of free speech debate from morning to evening. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Jacob, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.